What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Galen Elmore. I found Galen because he's now working through an organization I know well called the Forgotten Initiative, which works with churches and people around the country to get foster care ministries off the ground. It's awesome. And Galen is now working for them, helping mentor people. And he can do all that mainly through his experience in the foster care system. And so in today's episode, we talk about Galen's growing up in the foster care system and in multiple different homes. We talk about what his life was like and how that changes. We talk about the foster care system, what it's like, what it's supposed to do. We also talk about Galen and his love of sports. And so Galen goes through, he goes to D1 school in Minnesota and actually gets drafted into the NFL and realizes that he can't serve God and play in the NFL like he wants to. And so he retires early from the NFL. And so we talk about the why behind all that. We get to hear his really impactful salvation story. Y'all, there is so much to this episode, so much good stuff. You're going to love hearing from Galen. He's just a great guy and is so wise and just has so much good stuff to talk about in this episode. He's also going to be at the Replanted Conference, which is a conference for adoptive foster families, workers, and people who just want to know more about the adoption and foster care world. So that happens outside of Chicago here, but also is simulcast across the country. So it's pretty likely you can find somewhere to go see that, or you know, figure out a way to view that content. It's going to be awesome. I can't wait to hear Galen share his story at that conference. So I'll put all that in the show notes. Before we get to the episode, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with all the cool things we got going on the podcast, all the awesome people we have on the show. So I hope you enjoy hearing from Galen. Well, Galen, thanks so much for making some time for me and coming on the podcast. I'm excited to chat.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and just get a chance to connect with you and your audience a little bit.
I love it, man. I love it. Okay, let's jump off here and just have you kind of introduce, do the quick intro to who you are and all that stuff.
Yeah, so my name is Galen Elmore. I am 25 years old. I have to think about that sometimes now. But 25 years old, I am a former foster youth. I spent over 10 years of my childhood in foster care, bouncing around in different homes. I am the only child my parents had, so I have five half siblings. My parents struggled with alcohol and drug addiction, and that was the main reason I was in foster care. They were pretty high functioning addicts, but it was something that still took precedent over other important priorities in their life. And that led to people stepping in on our behalf. In that time in foster care, I stayed in over 20 different homes, bounced around a ton. Oddly enough, I had a stint at a home I stayed there for over 5 years. So really over 20 homes in five-ish, about 5.5 years, because I was in one home for 5 years alone. And yeah, that home, ironically unfortunately being the one I stayed at the longest, was a home I was actually physically and emotionally abused in. And just happened for the entire 5 years we were there. Something that really became a big barrier in my life, especially in my faith. That was the home that I was actually introduced to God and church in. Mm. And so we were a part of church. I did everything for 6 out of 7 days a week. And that's all we would do. I wasn't part of extracurriculars, didn't play sports, didn't do anything else. Went to school, came home, went to church, came home. In between there was abused. And that was my lived experience for 5 years of my life, from age 6 until I was 11. I eventually ended up getting back from my dad when I was 12. And that there's a whole story within that is really has a lot of twists and turns to it. But got back with my dad, we struggled just financially getting back on our feet. It was his first time having a child in his home for over 8 years. Mm-hmm. That we were strangers practically and had to get to know each other again. And I'm 12, 13, going through puberty, like just angry at the world a lot of times being a teenage boy, and my dad being clean at the time. But my dad's also a veteran. He has a lot of PTSD, a lot of depression, things that he struggles with. So just a lot of turmoil there. My dad ended up getting in some legal trouble when I was a sophomore in high school. So we had been together for about 3 years, 3.5 years at that point. And I was about to be put back into foster care. And I was really going to drop out and try to become an emancipated minor. Mm-hmm. There was one of my sisters that I was in foster care with, like one of my half sisters. She had become an emancipated minor when she was 15. I was 16 at the time. I felt very capable of doing that. So I was ready to essentially throw what future I thought I had away in order to just be free and not have to go back into the foster care system. And as I was planning and plotting to do that, my high school football coach actually stepped in, offered to take me in and coordinated the details with my dad. He ended up becoming my temporary guardian. I finished out my high school career in his house. I ended up becoming a nationally recruited football player. I really could have went anywhere in the country that I wanted to, but for whatever reason, it was close to the community that I went to high school in. I decided to go to the University of Minnesota, and there's some other spiritual things that happened that along the way that I couldn't explain at the moment, but made sense later. So I ended up going to the University of Minnesota, which was my first scholarship offer. And a lot of people questioned why I would do that, because we weren't very good at the time. And so I ended up going there, was super excited about being there. But once I was there, I fully, like a couple years into it, I really understood it was much bigger than football. Like the reason I was there, the purpose I was there, I ended up going there and got a part of a college ministry that I ended up giving my life to Christ. And just he radically changed a lot about me in that time. I became a leader on our team. I started discipling other guys on our team, and my whole worldview changed, which was a really cool thing. At the same time, I'm still in love with football, still playing, still having success. But then I start to feel this war between an idol in my life, which was football, which was fame, money, comfort, and what God was calling me to. And I continue to wrestle with that, figure out what that meant for me in my life. And I ended up getting a shot to play in the NFL, signed a contract with the Cincinnati Bengals, started to like be in that world, see what that that life had for me, and just felt it like creating this, what I felt like it was a massive gap between me, God, and the man God wanted me to be. And so at the ripe age of 22, I retired from the NFL. Not having a job lined up, having no idea what I was going to do. I ended up stumbling into a youth ministry job back in the Twin Cities where I went to school or where I graduated from. And I got the job, started serving youth ministry, and we were just trying to bring the gospel to kids who were experiencing hopelessness. Yeah. It was a ministry that started as serving at-risk youth, so kids with difficult, adverse backgrounds, but realizing like that's a very exclusive way to bring the gospel to teenagers. And so we started focusing on hopelessness, which was way more wide reaching and wide casting a much bigger net for youth. It's easy for parents to look at their kids and say, my kid isn't at risk, but it's not easy for a parent to look at their kid and say, my kid doesn't experience hopelessness. And we all do, no matter what economic background, whatever. So I was a part of that ministry for about 2 years. When I really started to feel like more and more passion for using the experiences I have, what God has done in my life to impact change for other people. So that was the main reason I really wanted to be a part of that ministry, was because there were kids in shoes that I was in that didn't have guidance that I didn't have. And I had to navigate it on my own and trying to point them back, give them perspective and advice that I didn't have. And so that led me to looking into speaking more and using the things that I experienced to have an impact in the foster care space, in the abuse or trauma resilience belonging space for people who work with kids with difficult situations or backgrounds, which then connected me to the Forgotten Initiative. Yeah. I got connected with the Forgotten Podcast and Jamie Cabe and the team here, where they ended up having an opening on their team. And so I applied and ended up accepting a job. So now I also do speaking and things like that, but I also full-time work for the Forgotten Initiative, which we're a Christian foster care ministry that our goal is to help people launch and lead thriving foster care ministries. And what I do basically is I'm the advocate coach. So all of our partners are volunteers. We don't pay them. They don't raise support for themselves. They're volunteers. We essentially like give them all the support. We help them launch a ministry, a thriving ministry in their community. And my role is to coach them. So that's what I do now. Yeah. That's as fast as I can sum it all up.
That's good, man. That's good. That's a lot of story. You have a lot of story to tell, at the age of 25, and there's so much there to unpack, but I just have to say, I love the Forgotten Initiative. I love what y'all got going on, and, totally. We go way back with them. And so I'm excited that you're a part of that team and stuff, man. I love it. So, okay, let's step back and let's walk through your story a little bit. I think there's a lot of ignorance in this world about what the foster care system even is or does.
Definitely.
The point, all of those things. Can you talk just a little bit about the foster care system and what it's like to grow up in that system?
I think I do want to start with the idea of ignorance too, because there's such a bad negative connotation to that word. It's simply like you're unaware, you don't know.
Right.
Like we all start ignorant about just about everything in life. There is nothing you're immediately... other than like the innate actions of being a human, right? So walking, like those things like that, we're ignorant. So it's a natural place to be. Now, willfully being ignorant and staying where you are is not natural. That's where you get personalities that choose to do that. And so there are a lot of people that are ignorant about foster care, about what happens, about the agency workers, about the biological parents in general, about foster parents and about the foster youth. There's just every component, there's a lot of ignorance. And so from someone who even grew up in it, now that I'm working on the other side and trying to help and support social workers, to help and support foster parents, like there's perspective that I don't even have. And I lived in community with them. I was a center of that community for a long period of time. But yeah, it's such a weird and unnatural thing. It's so hard to explain in a way. So like, that's why I also don't get mad about people's ignorance about it, right? Like I am a child that is literally bouncing from home to home, living with people I have no clue who they are. And so my normal becomes not knowing who's taking care of me.
Yeah.
When I was originally removed because they felt like the people who were supposed to be taking care of me were not. And so being in foster care is like could easily be and arguably is one of the most like loneliest places or systems that we have in our country.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like there are other things that are a part of that, like homelessness, like that community is very isolated and lonely, right? There's not a lot of support for them. I would say like the foster care system can very easily be a part of that conversation.
Yeah.
And so, foster care is originally intended to be something that's allowing families that are struggling to be able to get the help and support that they need to better themselves, to be more fit to take care of their children, right? And so it's supposed to be this kind of placeholder that allows adults, parents to grow, heal, learn things that they weren't allowed to or weren't able to prior to having their children. Right. So it's kind of this like education. It's supposed to be this educational period of, okay, we're holding you accountable. We're going to make sure you do X, Y, and Z to better yourself or prove that you're capable of doing this so you can have your children. Foster care is not intended to be this alternative way for foster parents to have their own children. Yeah. It's not supposed to be this alternative way for kids who like have so much potential to get better lives. Like that's the idea of having a better life is relative. And so that's not even clear in and of itself, but that's the original hope for foster care, is that there's a system in place that's going to hold parents accountable to be able to take care of the children that they brought into this world, but also at the same time, giving them resources to do so.
Yeah. Right. And I think that gets lost, right, a lot in this, you know, in people's desire a lot of times for to adopt or whatever, they go through the foster care system, not realizing that that's not the intention of that, and shouldn't be a way in which you go about that sort of thing. So
yeah.
So you were placed in the foster care system at age 6, is that right?
No, so like that was the first time I was in that home that I ended up being in for 5 years.
Got it.
The first time I actually went into the system, I was 10 months old.
10 months old. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Wow. So, I mean, so in your first, so was that the last, when you were 11, that's, and got out of that abusive home, that's when you went back with your biological father. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when I was taken out 11 from that home and I bounced around to like two more foster homes. Then I ended up being at one for about 6 to maybe 8 months. Okay. In my sixth grade year. And then I went from there back to my dad. So there was kind of this transitionary period. Like everything was really stagnant when I was in the abusive home. Like it was one of the pillar foster homes in our community. Like we had 8+ foster kids in the home at a time. Wow. They were notorious for taking in sibling groups. So like they had this esteem among everyone else. And so like my case, nothing with my like reunification was moving while I was in that home. But then when I'm like the abuse became public and we were removed, everything happened so quickly. Whereas like I hadn't seen my dad for like two and a half years. And then all of a sudden I'm doing overnight visits 3 months after I'm removed from that home. And then 8 months later, I'm back with him like that. So that's that transitionary period happened after I left that home.
Wow. Wow. I keep thinking about, I mean, 10 months old, like you're so much of that time period is sort of forming who you are, right? Like you're figuring out your identity and, you know, your relationship to those around you. Like, what was it like, you know, growing up, like kind of in so many different places?
It's weird because this abnormal thing becomes my normal. Mm. And so like, I'm this, for lack of a better word, weirdo, like navigating this world with a completely different reality than everyone else. It tremendously impacted who I was. One, I struggled with attachment so much. Like because I got so comfortable and used to moving, to uprooting everything, to having everything just like change on a dime. Since I was so used to that, I sought that out. I started to seek that out in my relationships. And I really didn't feel the weight of that until I was in high school and I was like solidified in a way. Like once I got with my high school coach, nothing was going to change. Like that security blanket of everything completely changing and becoming new after a certain period of time was no longer there. It was gone because they were rooted in their community. And as long as I was with them, that was not going to change. And so I started to see it in the relation way I treated friends, the ways that the girls that I liked, how I responded to them at that time, the way I treated teachers or coaches. Like I really started to see that happening at that point. Previously, there was a natural, like I moved or I changed schools or I did this or I did that. And then naturally severed those relationships. But when I was forced to be in a place for a longer period of time, and I didn't have that security blanket of this is naturally going to change for me, I really struggled. And so it's honestly, I just got so good over my childhood at making things seem as though they're good when they're not. And so I got really good at forming what other people would see as friendships. But the reality is they had no idea who I was. They knew nothing about me. I would never go to their home. They would never come to mine. And that just was normal. No one questioned it. It's because I was an outgoing kid. I was super like popular or likable. And I played like I was athletic. And so there was just all these things that people would see as, oh, like everything's great with Galen. But it wasn't. And so it wasn't until I was with my high school coach where that stuff started to rear its ugly head, but it was such a big part of who I was and like still am. And it's continually trying to renew that and redeem, or like allowing God to redeem those things in my life. But it's weird because I even think about it now in the context of, so I, with the stuff I do with belonging is primarily with school districts and creating a space where all students feel welcomed and a part of a community and accepted. Right. And so like for me, that's a big deal, because for those years from 6 to 11 that I was in that home, I really feel like the only thing that kept me going was the elementary school that I was a part of. I ended up going to a Montessori school that was just tremendously impactful for how I viewed education, but how I viewed relationships with adults. Like, I wasn't forming good opinions on like caretakers or adults in positions of power, because my parents weren't able to take care of me, and I held some contempt for them in that. And my guardians were either getting rid of me after a certain amount of time or were abusing me. And so I had a messed up view of how people viewed me, but being at that school was so impactful because I saw teachers who really didn't have to care about me in a, on a deeper level, or care about me beyond what I'm doing in their class. And they all took a deep investment in who I was as a person. And so, but I say that because like now I do that work. And I just think about the other kids who are good at making new friends or making other people like feel like they know them, but they actually don't, because I was so good at that. I would go to a new school, like from preschool to first grade, I went to 4 different schools. And then from first grade, I was in the same school from first to sixth. But then from 7th to 9th grade, I went to 3 different schools. And so like, I was just always thrown into a new situation and was like, all right, I can make something happen out of this. But that's not normal. Like, we're meant to be in relationship. We're meant to be in community. That's biblical. We're meant to be known like fully and to be loved deeply. Yeah. And that was just something that was so foreign and scary to me that it was ingrained in who I was. And I didn't want anything to do with those kind of relationships.
Wow. What role did I know you had talked about being in a home with one of your half siblings. What role did like those relationships play like out during that time?
Yeah. I was actually with both of my sisters.
Okay.
So 2 of my sisters, we went through foster care for the majority of it together. Okay. We were in foster care for a majority of the time together. And the reason I bounced around to so many homes at the beginning was because we weren't together. Mm. And so there was, I was taken away from my parents multiple times, but there's one time I remember it. I was like, it was like 4, like around that 3-4 year old range. My sisters were gone at school. I wasn't old enough to be at school yet. And I remember them coming and like I remember the exchange and encounter that happened with my, caseworker who was new at the time. He was not one I had, before. He was a new guy that showed up and was like, had an altercation with my mom about like taking me. My dad was gone to work. He worked third shift. So he was gone. And they ended up taking me. And I remember going in his car and sitting in the car thinking, what can I do to take control of this situation? And I'm 4 years old, and every reality out there, there's nothing I can do that can allow me to take control of this situation. Right. But that's where my mind was. And my decision in that moment was, I'm not going to let anyone think that me being in foster care is a good thing. That means I'm not going to smile. I'm not going to laugh. I'm not going to have fun. I'm not going to talk to people. I'm not going to be nice to my foster parents. I remember making this decision. I was like, I'm going to shut everyone out. And if I do that for long enough, they have to like bring me back home, because they'll see that this isn't good for me. And so I made that decision. And for the first couple months, like, I was the youngest out of my siblings. My sisters were 7 and 10 at the time. Okay. And so much harder to get in foster care to group together a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 10-year-old. Yeah. A lot easier to find a home for a 4-year-old boy, 3-year-old, 4-year-old boy. And So I went to a lot of homes by myself, and I just burned bridges with foster parent after foster parent because I was not willing to let them in. There was no way I was going to do it. And if you know me, like, I'm a very like strong-willed, stubborn person today. And I know, like, people tell me I was then as well. And so when I made that decision, I was sticking to it.
Yeah.
And so I fully believe that that contributed to me bouncing around so much because people would like try to break my walls down. It wouldn't work. I'm like, all right, we can't do it. We're not helping. We're not doing anything. And I really feel like they were good foster parents, like well-meaning people that just, it's like, we can't do this. And so I moved around until like I got placed with one of my sisters. And then at that point I was like, okay, I can maybe let my guard down a little bit. Like I'm at least, like, I'm not home, but I'm at least with one of my sisters. So it's kind of like home. And then we were together and we kind of just stuck together for a while. And that was my 7-year-old sister. And we just stuck together for a while. And then we bounced to a couple different homes together. And then we got put with our other sister, and that was in the abusive home. So she was already there. And then we got moved to like that home with her. And yeah, that by the time that happened, I was 6. So it was some time in between there. Yeah. It wasn't quick that happened, but I was 6. My older sister at that time was around 13, 14. So we actually, all three of us being together, only happened for like 2 years, maybe. It wasn't a super long time because my sister ended up becoming emancipated at 15. Okay. So yeah, it was really helpful for me because, like, depending on what area of foster care you get in, it's kind of like its own little wild, wild west. Like, you have this population of youth who are experienced to things that some adults have never been experienced to. Right. That are navigating life relatively on their own. And so it's like you have these adults who are the real authority in life. And then when the adults leave, like, there's this kind of new assumed power among the foster kids. And so as the youngest, always in the room, like, it was very helpful for me to have two sisters who like had some experience or knew how to navigate that. And so, like, yeah, we definitely were not a part of this beautiful like idea of what foster care was. We were part of the like rugged blue collar aspect of foster care, where you just have a lot of kids who have a lot of pain and anger about the cards they've been dealt, and people have just kind of tossed them to the side because the rates at which teenagers in foster care get cared for is not very high. It's very, very low. And that's just a lot of the people that we were navigating it with. And so it was extremely helpful for me as a young kid in foster care, in those kind of spaces, to have siblings that I could like be connected to and be connected with.
Yeah. Yeah. I went through when I was, in middle school, my parents went through a divorce and it was pretty tumultuous. Right. And we were like, we bounced back and forth to the house. Like, we were every other day we were at the other house, you know, and like, it made me and my sister so close. Right. Cause you get to a point where that's all you have, right? Like, is that sibling. And it just makes you cling to those relationships, I think, in important ways. So. Okay. So one of the things also a part of foster care and all of this stuff, and I'm making a lot of assumptions about this home that you were in, but there's a lot of like white savior mentality, right? In foster care. I mean, is that something you experienced as you sort of like thought about yourself as, a person of color, as opposed to, you know, did that figure into like how you sort of formed identity and all of that stuff?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, so backstory, I'm multiracial. I'm a Black man, right? But my mom is European American. So my mom's white and my dad is African American. He's Black. And my sisters are the same as well, even though we're half siblings, like the same is true for them. So we're multiracial navigating this space. Yeah. We identify with the Black community. Actually, I would say I didn't as closely identify with the Black community until I was in foster care. Until I was around strictly people of color, that's when like I started to identify and like I had similar experiences to them. And so when I was in foster care, that most of the homes, like those early homes when I was like 3, 4 and people wanted me, those are white families. And those are like some of the people that I didn't stay with very long. The ones as we got older and I was with my siblings, those were black families that were willing to take us in. Okay. And so the abusive home was a black household. But the white savior complex really didn't play a factor for me until I was in high school and middle school, when I wasn't even in foster care anymore. And so there was a lot of people, because I got really good at navigating like adversity. Like that's all I knew, but I was always a good student. Like I said, my experience in that elementary school was so impactful for the trajectory of my life. I was always an honor roll student. I was always excelling like athletically. I had good manners. Like I was the ideal child. There's a lot of my friends who would say, like, I just want my kid to be like you. And like, that was my experience. Right. But it wasn't until like I got into like that middle school. And we, at this point, we moved from Illinois. When I was in middle school, we moved from Illinois to Wisconsin. Okay. And so we moved from communities of color to rural white communities, where I was one of the few people who like lived somewhere else and moved there. So I was like one of the few transplants. And I just had a lot of families, a lot of well-meaning white families tell me how like much more successful I could be if like I had a stable home, or how like they could help me get much further than what my family could do, which made it even more like challenging for me to already to accept help that was already really hard for me to accept anyway, because I was a very prideful person. My dad was a very prideful person. Even though we struggled, like we're like, this is ours and we're going to do it together. But there was a lot of people who would tell me to my face as a 13-year-old, like, man, I don't know how you turned out as good as you did. But if you were to be with us, like you'd have the world at your fingertips. And so like that is a thing, like, right. It didn't even take foster care for me to be exposed to that. It took me to have white friends, for that to happen. And I just now look at it and just think how many like well-meaning, like white people think that when they see someone with potential that has a harder or more challenging story, like less obstacles in the way does not mean more success. That's what a lot of people attribute to success, is having less obstacles. And so, yeah, it's definitely a thing. In my experience in foster care, I spent majority of my time in a black household and multiple black households. And so, but I also think that's locationally too, right? Like there's just, it depends on the demographic of the area you're living in. And I was in a predominantly like black town, and that's what my experience was.
Interesting. Well, and I'm sure all of that like stuff going on in middle school and high school had to do with you being really good at football, you know, in Wisconsin, right? And like everybody wanting to sort of be a part of that success, or like, you know,
Yeah, there were some hard conversations, and like I will always be respectful. I really value respect, and but I value honesty and being able to be transparent with people. And so even at that age, like that's something I would do. And the people who like acknowledged it and were willing to like learn and grow are still family to me. Like they're part of my life. They're 100% family in my book. But there's a lot of people who've fallen off the wayside because it has been attached to my abilities, like their relationship, their commitment to help me has been attached to my abilities more so than me as a person. And that's a hard thing to navigate as a teenager by yourself, because I was the first person, the first male in my family to graduate high school. I was like, so soon as I get to high school, I'm entering into a world that no one else in my family has ever been a part of.
Right.
And so like I was navigating all of that on my own and trying to figure out what that meant for me and my story and my future. So yeah, it was definitely a big part of that.
how football doesn't become like an all-encompassing identity for you is like sort of beyond me, right? I played football in high school in Texas, you know, but even I go back to Texas and like see just the way that football is. I mean, football can just become like all encompassing so easily. And I'm sure it's the same where you were in Wisconsin, which is a big football state. How in the world did you not like sort of let all that sort of just envelop who you were?
So it did. And I would argue it still is. And so that's why I couldn't play anymore. Right. Like I had to like cut my arm off before it made me sin. Right. Like, so like there is an element of that was my identity. That was who I, that was going to change my, the future of my family, the future generations. It was going to save me from my lack of like, in intimate relationships. It was going to solve every problem I ever had. And I felt that way as a child. Like, and that's the thing. Like this is one thing I can't explain as much, but there was just this part of me that was ingrained into my being as a baby that felt this weight to be the person that was going to change everything for my family. My mom tells me stories of me as a toddler watching the Super Bowl with my like family, and that like, so I was like 2-3 in that range that we were home, and telling her like, I'm going to be in the NFL one day. I'm going to show everyone how to do it. Wow. Like I'm going to show people how it's done. And like, I just always, there was never a moment that I looked back. It's like, that was the moment I knew like the weight of my family was on me, but that's how I operated and navigated life always. So seeing athletes, seeing like, okay, I want to do that. I want to be that. I want to do whatever I have to do to get to that level. And so I was a football and basketball player, and football ended up becoming the route because it was going to be the easier road, in my opinion. Okay. Like at that time, so I'm 6'5", 6'5" and a half on a good day. When I was playing high school basketball and travel basketball, like it wasn't the NBA today where there's commonly 6'5", 6'6" players that play multiple. It's positionless basketball now.
Yeah.
It wasn't that then. I was like, I was playing AU basketball and I would play against guys who were 6'9" and I was just like, okay, this isn't my route. And so I got a lot of praise from college coaches for football and pursued that, but that was going to be the route for me. And I knew I had to figure out whatever it was going to be to get me there. And once I got there in college and in the pros, it was just, it was so deeply rooted in who I was. And I consistently prayed. I was like, God, like take this cup from me. Like, let me not put football in the place in the like throne of my life that you're supposed to be in. Like, let me separate the two so I can continue to play. And it just was not happening. And it was the scariest decision I've ever made in my life to walk away from it. But, and there's days I question it. There's times that like I'm in my flesh and I don't know what I did or why I did it. But when I'm in the spirit, when I'm hearing God's voice clearly, I know that he had greater things for me. He has greater things for me than just making money through a sport. And so it's a massive part of who I was. And like, I started to realize like only relationships I have is through me being an athlete, is through me being a football player. This is around the same time as the like boom of social media. And so I have all these ways to interact with fans and people who like have heard my story, followed me, and like starting to like covet that, but that's not real. Those are people that we see all the time, like social media fans turn on an athlete when something doesn't go their way. And
right,
it just, I had an identity crisis. Like before I even accepted Christ, I had an identity crisis of like, what is this? Like who do I think I am? I don't know who I can trust. I don't know anything. And I like deleted all my social media like months before I ever went to a Christian camp that I ended up giving my life to Christ at. And so that was a thing that I was still wrestling with before like the supreme word of God was the standard that I was trying to live by. And yeah, so I can say it's not my identity now because I'm removed from it.
Yeah.
If I were in that, like there was like a year and a half ago, I considered like starting to train and try to go back. And like if I were to go back into it, I don't think anything would change. Like I'm a lot more knowledgeable of who God is. He's a much bigger part of my life now, but I still don't know if like all of that would still be the same if I were to go back to football, just because it's so something I coveted for so long. Mm. And yeah.
Dude, it's just like, I mean, that is like so countercultural, right? Like it's hard. I mean, all I could say is Jesus, right? I mean, there's no other power that could make somebody who has their lifelong dreams like in the palm of their hands give that up for something greater, for the kingdom, right? And like, I mean, that's a lot of the reason I'm here talking about work, right? Because that's pretty mind-boggling and amazing that the Spirit just worked in you like that. Do you mind talking a little bit just about getting saved and what that experience was like?
Yeah, so naturally it had to be involved with sport. So I was a part of a college ministry. Because I was exposed to the church when I was in foster care, I lived my whole life thinking I was Christian, thinking like, I don't lie, cheat, steal, kill. Like I relatively obey the 10 commandments, honor thy mother and father didn't apply to me because I was a foster kid. Mm. So it was like, generally I'm obeying it. Like I pray, I believe in God, like I'm saved. And it wasn't until I got to college that I saw people who were doing ministry, like living it out, like, oh, like we're going to have you guys over to my house. You're going to eat family with my wife, my kids. We're going to talk about Jesus. We're going to see how that, like you can live this out and for you. And we're going to teach you how to do this. I was being discipled.
Yeah.
But going into it, they were talking about these discipleship groups. And it was basically like, they basically marketed it as a Bible study. And I was like, cool. Like, I'll go. I'm a Christian. I'll show up. I'll give God this 1 hour of my 7 day week, and that'll continue to keep my relationship with Him where I want it to be. And I'll go live, do the college life, do everything I want to do outside of that. But as long as I have that 1 hour a week, like I'm good.
Yeah.
And so I'm going there, and so it's Athletes in Action, which is a college athlete ministry through Crew, and they have this camp that they do like nationally every year. So it's a Christian athlete camp that's geared towards teaching you how to use your sport, your talents, your gifts to worship and honor God on the playing field or on the court, in the pool, wherever your sport is. So a variety of different types of athletes, all levels, D1, D2, D3, NAIA, JUCO, whoever. If you're a college athlete, you can go. And I originally didn't want to go, never been to a Christian camp. I just assumed it was, someone's going to have an acoustic guitar by a campfire and you're going to sing church songs. And I was like, there's no way I'm spending part of my like break. Right. So like we get a break as college football players, you get two breaks a year. You get a break at the end of the season going into the spring semester. So it's like a 2 week break, 'cause you have to come back early to lift and do everything before other students get back.
Yeah.
And you get a break at the end of summer or at the end of the spring semester going into the summer. You get like a 2 week, maybe 3 week, depending on how early workouts end, break before you hit the ground running, and you don't have another break till December. And I was like, there's no way I'm using 1 week of my break to go to this camp and like sing campfire songs with all these weirdos. Like, I'm not doing it. And because I've always like tried to be respectful and honor people's time, like even when I was getting recruited, I was top 15 in my position in my class, but I would still take calls from D3 schools. I would still take calls from every school because I didn't want to burn bridges. I didn't want to be disrespectful to someone's like passion, what they work hard at. So I would take all the calls. And so same way with this ministry, like they would do these dinners that they would invite all the people who are in discipleship groups. They would do a lesson, would talk, but they started talking about the camp and the advertising, marketing it. And they were like, if you apply, because you have to apply, get accepted, and then you fundraise or you get the money or whatever. They're like, if you just sign up tonight, like just apply, you'll enter your name into a drawing to get a half scholarship to go to the camp. And my discipler at the time was harassing me. It was like, dude, you just sign up, just apply. If you don't get the scholarship, like, I'm not going to ask you about it again. So I really think I'll set up. but naturally I do it. I ended up getting the half scholarship. I ended up winning it. And I was like, shoot, now I have to go. And so they helped me raise the other part of the money for it, because again, being a former foster kid, I didn't have financial support. I didn't have people who were going to like pay for me to go to this Christian camp. I didn't have any community that would really pour into me in that way. And so, or I also felt like I was already too indebted by help that I had already gotten. So I wasn't going to continue to ask people for more. So they ended up helping me get it. And I go to this camp, and like, man, it's honestly the most unbelievable experience that I've ever had. And I tell everyone I know that is a college athlete, like, you have to go. So like, they set it up in this, and so this is going to be like a pitch for this camp, really. They set it up in like competitive, like game format. So they have this portion that's called like the film room, which is where you go to like learn new ideas, new tactics, understand things better in the sports sense. But for this Christian sense, we're like learning scripture, we're learning principles about God's word and how he talks about sport in his word and how it's applicable to us. And so you do the film room, then you go out and practice it. So we have a really low stakes, they choose volleyball. So everyone's playing volleyball to learn how to apply what we're talking about. It's really low stakes. So you do that for like 3 days, morning session, night session, do that for 3 days. There's worship in between. And then there's this thing called the special, which is this 20-hour workout over the course of 24 hours. You're on teams, you're is drafted. There's a winner, there's a loser. Like, it's super competitive. And that is like where they really test you to see if you're going to apply in a very intense environment what you are learning. And man, it was the most like picture perfect roller coaster of emotion, like type thing that I've ever experienced. I went from like wanting to fight some of the interns to wanting to walk out to hysterically laughing at what we were doing to breaking down in tears at something that was just like one of the most beautiful things ever. And so there's a lot of stuff that happens, and I'll skip past the details to this last point where the last thing they do is not competitive at all. It's called Golgotha, which is the Christ that, or the hill that Christ was crucified on. And it's an individual event where you run a half mile down a hill carrying a 2x4. It's quiet. You're not talking. Like, again, you're just going at your own pace. You're going down this hill, and at the bottom, they read scripture to you and tell you to take up your cross and follow me. And so then you put the 2x4 on your back, and then you're running up this hill with the 2x4. It's signifying you carrying your cross. And on the way down, like, I had, again, I had a rough event. Like, I'm super competitive. I'm super prideful, cocky. Like, I'm the most athletic, like, talented person here. Like, my team, we probably took last. We won one event out of the 20 things we did. So that was really big gut check for me. And so like, I had went through a lot of different emotions where I was just going down the hill talking to God. I was like, all right, God, I'm here. Like, they say you want something for me. I don't know what that is. Like, can you tell, like, you tell me what you want? Like, what do you want from me? Why am I here? I don't want this to be a waste of my time, because I'm here. And so they read the scripture to me. I'm on the way. I start to turn the corner going back up the hill, and I internally just hear like the Spirit talk to me and felt like God was telling me, you've held back all week. You haven't given me, like, you haven't given everything to me. You've just kind of shrugged at this whole thing. And I'm talking back, and then like God tells me, is just give me everything you got right now. Like, forget everything else. Give me everything you have right now. And it's a half mile run up a hill. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? Like, I don't, like, there's not a lot of time left. What does it mean? And it's like, immediately sprint. And so it's not competitive. There's tons of people in front of me and I just take off sprinting the whole way up the hill and I'm running past people, not worried about them. I'm just thinking like, all right, this is what you asked for me and asked of me and I'm going to give it. And I'm going to do my part. And so I sprint all the way up the hill. At the top of the hill, there's people that are waiting to take your cross off of your back with you. And when they do that, they again, speak scripture into you and tell you, well done, good and faithful servant. And they help you take the cross off your back. And there's just this image of that's ingrained in my head of all these people worshiping and celebrating you coming to the top of like carrying your cross. It's like a image of heaven of like all these people just celebrating and worshiping like what you just went through. And the moment I took, like they helped me take the cross off my back, I just buckled, like just dropped and started weeping. And as I'm weeping, like I see and hear like all these things flashing through my mind. Like, and it's literally me entering foster care, sitting in that car of my foster or of my social worker when I was taken away from my parents, to the time that I like was abused and like had to sit in church, to the time that I walked to school because I was scared of being abused, to the time that me and my dad were homeless, to the time that my dad was taken away from me, like all these life moments up until that moment. I just felt God tell me, he was like, I know you like hold on to a lot of the things of your past and you may not ever fully understand why you went through what you went through, but I will say like, look at where we are and we've never been closer. And I just like, I lost it. And that is like, I just felt so loved and seen and heard because I held up, I had so much anger for who God was because I heard all these great and magnificent things about who he was and how much he loved us and how his son died on the cross for us and all these things. But I'm like, I'm a child and I don't have a family. I don't have a home. I don't have all these things that all these other people who take it for granted have. And you're going to tell me you love me. And in that moment, I just felt so loved like I've never felt before. And I just felt all of this like weight, like just fly off my shoulders and legitimately felt like I saw the world in a new way. And I walked away from that camp, a completely different person, not being able to explain it to anybody, being able to like share my story with people and be okay with it, to like being okay at like trying to form deep relationship and being rejected. Like all of those things happened overnight, essentially. And like, it wasn't perfect from that day on. Like I had many bumps in the road and like my attempt to follow Christ. But like my life was changed ever since that day. And from that day on, the battle between God being like the person or being in the throne of my life and football being in it, like that battle started all the way to the point of me walking away from football, where that was like the end of that battle where God had won. And so, that experience was so unbelievable. I love sharing it, but I get chills and emotional every single time because it's just such a representation of how God meets us where we are. Like that. Yeah, it was the best experience I've ever had. And small, like a supplemental side note to it, I met my wife there too. She was at the camp as well. We didn't connect right away, but a couple of years later we got connected. We're married, have a daughter now. And yeah,
bro, you got me over here tearing up too. And gosh, that's such a powerful story. I appreciate you being willing to share it. Galen, it has been so nice to get to know you, hear your story. I just appreciate you being willing to share with me. And we didn't even get to talking about the Bengals and, you know, like retirement and all that stuff. So maybe we'll have to circle back for that story at some other time. But what are the best ways for people to sort of find you and, you know, what you got going on and all that stuff?
Yeah. So I'm on social media. I believe you can just search my name in Galen Elmore on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. My handle on Instagram is GIV.Elmore. So my initials spell give. And so, okay. That's where that comes from. So GIV, galen.elmore. And then I have a website as well, www.galenspeaks.com. That's where, like, if you want to inquire about any speaking things or anything like that, my information's on there. But yeah, just, I love to interact with people, Instagram, Facebook. It's all about like growing and like our understanding for who God is, the world, and helping other people do that as well. So I love to engage in that way.
I love it. I'll make sure all that's in the show notes for everybody. Do you mind if we jump into the final two questions as we close up here?
Go ahead.
All right. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah. So I'm going to say this is the strangest job out of lack of having like other options. So it's no shade at any farmers out there. But if you can picture 6'3", 15-year-old Galen, that's a twig, like working on a farm in like basketball shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
That is the weirdest job I've ever had. Like just even being able to think back now and reflect, like, man, I used to, after workouts, like in high school, I used to go to this guy's farm and like bell hay. And I used to like help him put up fences for his horses. And like, I'm not a farm person by any means. I'm a city person through and through. I'm a city guy.
Yeah.
Have no problem with getting my hands dirty, but that is not like how I envision spending my time. And so it's hard work, and I have so much respect for farmers because of it. But that is by far the weirdest job that I've had, just because I was the odd person out. I was definitely a sore thumb, or however that phrase goes in that situation. Yeah, that would be my answer.
I love it. You learn a lot of skills farming, though. I mean, it teaches you some serious skills. So that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah. So I do, like you were saying, I do think I have an interesting perspective here, because I do have an example of where I felt like I wasn't able to do that. Right.
Yeah.
And there were so many people in my life that were like, man, you got to be the light in that space. And I was just like, that light is meant for someone else. I'm not the one that's like destined to do that for the NFL. And so what I would say is like, find what like authentic evangelism or ministry looks like to you. Like, are you that street evangelizer? Like, is that who you are? Is like, oh, I'm just going to make everything about God and like carry this conversation into something that's different. Are you the person that's like, oh, I'm just going to live a certain way and hope that people ask questions and leads the conversation? Like, what does authentic ministry look like to you? Mm-hmm. Don't go and try to apply something someone else does just because it worked for them, because it may not be real for you. God wants us to do ministry in our vocation, in our work. But it's always authentic to who he is and who he calls us to be. And so I know for me, what's authentic to me is doing it in community. I always want to invite people to come be a part of my life in a different way. So inviting them over for major events. So inviting people to like, come to my house. We're going to do something for Halloween, or we're going to do something for the Super Bowl. Like me and my wife are very community oriented people. We're very extroverted. We love doing life like that. And so inviting people who may not like traditionally view that in a Christian or sanctified way, and invite them to be a part of it and see a different way for it to happen. Right. Like we, a couple of years ago, like one of my favorite holidays, I don't know why, maybe it's because of movies, but one of my favorite holidays is New Year's. And there's just a really hard, like, it's really challenging to do New Year's in a like Christ-centered way. Sure. And so like, we threw a party and we invited a ton of different people to come like be a part of it, where it's not about like finding someone to kiss at midnight, and it's not about like getting drunk or doing anything like that. We wanted people to have fun, to see that there's a way to be who you are and still engage with other people in community, whether they're from your background or not. And so I would encourage anyone to do it in that way, is find what's authentic to you, find what you're passionate about, what you can invite other people in to be a part of, and just go with that. I think there's never there's always enough space for people to be who they are. That's what we need more of in the world, especially from the Christian community. We need more people being authentic to God and being authentic to who God has uniquely made them to be.
Yeah. I love that. I totally, I agree. And I think that's such good, encouragement for everybody. And thanks so much, Galen, for making time for me, man. I can't wait to see you at the conference coming up here in October. So.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet you in person. I had a blast being here. This time flew by. So I'm a big fan of the podcast and love what you got going. So I appreciate you letting me be a part of it.
Thanks, man. That means a lot. I appreciate it. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Galen. I hope you were as encouraged as I was by just talking to him and hearing his story and seeing how God moves. Just, I feel like I needed to hear his story of just experiencing God's love, even for myself. And so I hope you got a lot out of that. Please go check out everything Galen's got going on. Such good stuff. He's doing such amazing work in the foster care world and just, yeah, really important stuff. So I encourage you to check him out, follow him on all those socials. You could see him at the Replanted Conference if you would like, where he's going to be speaking. So much good stuff. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there for me just to help get the word out about the podcast and let people know people are listening. I greatly appreciate that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.